We get to begin a new book study tonight. That's always an exciting thing, at least for me it is. We were through the book of Ruth so quick. That went so quick, didn't it? Yeah, tough to even remember that a few years from now. Didn't we do that little tiny book? Yeah, that's right, we did. Tonight we get to start a larger volume, one of a two-volume set, 1 Samuel tonight, and then afterwards we'll go right into 2 Samuel. This book, as well as the book that follows, 2 Samuel, is named after its author, Samuel. He wrote this book, and there are some that say that someone else must have come in and finished the book, probably Nathan, and there's no way to know any of that. For sure, we do know that Samuel wrote the majority of these two volumes, and that is pretty substantial if you think about it, because the story that we're getting first off is the story of Samuel's mother, Hannah. You know, you kind of wonder, like, how did anyone know this? Where did this information come from? Was it just absolutely out of the blue revealed by the Lord? Well, no, my guess would be that since Samuel wrote this book, his mom probably sat him down at some point and told him this story, so it kind of opens up my understanding here. I think what we're reading is actually the story from the mouth of Hannah herself to her child. So that's intriguing to me. I think that adds all new layers to this. To give you a quick breakdown of the book, it would look something like this, just very roughly. Chapters 1 through 7 of 1 Samuel, that follows the life of Samuel. Now, his life doesn't stop there, it continues on, but the focus then in chapter 8 shifts away from Samuel, and chapters 8 through 15, that gives us the rise and fall of King Saul, Then chapters 16 through 31, that is all about the life of David, and of course we'll continue to get his story in 2 Samuel. And I think just that quick outline, it pretty much charts the course nicely. And if your deduction skills are very good, and I mean very good, then you already sense something big is happening in this book. There's a major transition that's coming. This is where God begins to transition the nation of Israel from or out of the time period of the judges and into the time period of the kings and the prophets, that is the monarch and the ministry, working hand in hand to decipher the Lord's will, to establish and organize the people, and then to establish rule within the monarchy. There has been quite a few transitions already, just beginning at Exodus and now into 1 Samuel for the nation of Israel. Of course, that first major transition was when Israel had departed from Egyptian bondage. The Lord had brought them out and set them free. That was a big transition, going from bondage, from slavery, into the glorious freedom of being able to know the Lord according to His Word and to be able to serve the Lord according to His Word. So that was a wonderful transition. Of course, all of that happening under the authority, under the leadership of Moses. And then the second major transition for the nation that we saw was, of course, the transition from the leadership of Moses into the leadership of Joshua. You might not expect that to be a very big transition, but actually, yeah, it really was. It wasn't just going from one guy to the next. That was a major transition in just about every aspect of Israeli life. First of all, you go from following the man, Moses, the lawgiver, in his authority, and now you're following the written word of God for the first time. That's what the book of Joshua told us, right? And then, you know, you go from being a sojourner to being settled in the land. And, you know, how does settled down life in Israel look? So a lot of change in the story of Joshua there as the transition from leadership occurs. And then the next major transition was from Joshua's leadership into the time period of the judges. And that was an unmitigated disaster. Things just kept getting out of hand, and the people were just doing what seemed right in their own estimation. And that was disaster after disaster. And the Lord would stop it at times and pull a judge in there to gather the people and organize and establish some rule. But then when that judge passed away, There was no clear line of succession. There was no clear line of succession. Well, who's going to take the place of this judge when he passes? Who's the next judge going to be? I don't know. I guess we'll wait around and see who identifies themselves as being extraordinary within the nation. Maybe that'll be the next judge. Well, and then that brings us to this transition that we are beginning to study tonight in 1 Samuel. And as I stated, that is the transition from the time period of the judges into the time period of the kings and prophets, or the monarch and the ministry. And this is a much better model for the nation of Israel than was the time period of the judges, obviously. Doesn't take much to do better than the time period of the judges, does it? I don't know that I would say this new model, the kingly line, the monarchy, I wouldn't say it was necessarily better than the Moses model. That was a good model because the guy at the top, well, he was a very solid guy. I would definitely, though, say it's better than the time period of the judges, because now you get, first of all, God's going to pick that second guy. Yeah, it's rough going at the beginning. There are some tough times under that first king, Saul. And that's because the Lord threw up his hands and gave the people what they wanted. They wanted a guy that looked like a king. Well, Saul was literally head and shoulders above everyone else. That's what the scriptures say. He was a tall guy, head and shoulders above the rest of the nation. This guy looked like a king. Well, then that's got to be the king. Well, no, the Lord doesn't judge based on appearance. He judges based on the heart. David is ultimately selected, and once David is selected, in comes the glory days of the nation of Israel. Hardly gets better than that. I think to find a better time period for the nation, you have to fast forward to something that hasn't happened yet. What would that be? The millennial kingdom of Christ, his rule and reign on the earth for 1,000 years. So it's a much better model because there's a plan of succession there. When one king goes, the next king, well, you know who it's going to be, and he's already ready to go. When David passes, things pass on to Solomon, and he's ready. So it is a much better plan, very beneficial for the nation. With that said, the young child that we'll meet in this chapter, Samuel, he is like the pivotal character for this time of transition for the nation of Israel. We're going to find out that he is the last of the judges. Now, when I gave you lists of judges, back when we were studying the book of Judges, I always gave you the list of names that was in the book of Judges because that's what we were studying. I don't know if I even mentioned this. I probably did at some point, but Samuel is actually a judge. He's the final judge. So we're back chronologically. We covered the book of Judges. We covered the book of Ruth. That took place during the time period of the judges. As 1 Samuel begins, it begins in that setting, the time period of the judges. This last judge, Samuel, will be raised up, but he won't just be a judge. He'll also be a prophet. And by most accounts in the Bible, he's considered like the first prophet. And the reason for that is not that there weren't prophets before Samuel. There were. We've studied plenty of prophets in the time period of the judges. Almost every judge had a prophet somewhere around them in the nation to kind of help them to get their finger on the pulse of God. Even Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 15, alluded to himself being a prophet when he predicted Jesus to come and said he would be a prophet like me. So yes, there have been prophets, but it's just different now. We're in a time period of prophets. It's almost like the word prophets goes from being lowercase p to uppercase p. We're now in the time period of the prophets, and beginning at Samuel and the prophets that follow him, Elijah, Elisha, you know, Daniel, all of these other prophets that we know well, they're just cut from a different cloth. They're just built different. It's like the difference kind of with the word apostle. You know, that word means sent one, a representative of Christ. And in the general sense, we're all apostles, and yet we reserve that word for the 12 apostles, don't we? Because that's like the difference between apostle, small a, lowercase a, and apostle, uppercase, capital A. That's kind of the difference with Samuel. It says in Acts chapter 13, verse 20, that after talking about the establishment of Israel and being settled into the promised land, Paul then says, "And after that, he, God, gave them judges," that's the time period of the judges, "until Samuel the prophet." So he is indeed the transitional figurehead. And I'll add this, he's kind of a big deal. Samuel is, he's kind of a big deal. We probably don't realize just how much so. We don't hear his name talked about a lot when we talk about the great godly examples, the great men of God or women of God from the Scriptures. You hear Moses all the time. Moses, usually number one or number two, real high on most people's lists, right? You got the prophets who did all of their signs and wonders. Elijah, who doesn't know that name? You hear about him a lot. We quote from the prophets a lot. We talk about the prophets a lot. Samuel's name doesn't seem to come up too often, it seems to me, at least not enough. And I think that really should change, because this guy Samuel, he's pretty high on the Lord's list. I know this is a very human way of looking at things, but I think the Lord gave us a clue to that in Jeremiah chapter 15, verse 1. Listen to what the Lord said. "Then the Lord said to me, 'Though Moses and Samuel stood before me, yet my heart would not turn toward this people.'" Now, first of all, you're pretty far gone if Moses and Samuel cannot intercede for you on behalf of the Lord. But that's not my point here. My point is, do you see how the Lord used the name of Samuel? This is in Jeremiah chapter 15, verse 1. Look how much history had happened up until this point. Look how many prophets Jeremiah could have included. Look how many names that the Lord could have thrown in there. But what two names does the Lord pick? He picks Moses and Samuel. Don't you think that says something? I mean, can you imagine your name on a list? Like the Lord saying to someone else, "Look, I don't care even if it's Moses and Arlen pleading for you. I'm still not going to change my mind." No, my name does not belong on that kind of list. And sorry to have to say it, but neither does yours. Guess whose name does belong on that list? Samuel. This guy is a phenomenal guy. And in order to learn about this fellow, well, we're going to have to begin the study, aren't we? We're going to have to actually start reading the chapter, and let's do that. I wanted to give you a quick introduction of this guy, Samuel, the prophet, the last of the judges, the first of the capital P prophets. But I don't want us to lose sight of someone's beautiful story in chapter 1, and that is a young gal by the name of Hannah. All right, let's begin reading in verse 1. "There was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim," say that three times fast, "Ramathaim Zophim," and that was just north of Jerusalem, and I mean directly north of Jerusalem, "of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuf." Man, I tell you, I get kind of jealous of all these super good Bible names. These Bible characters, they just got the best of names. Zuf is always one of my favorites. I really have really liked this name, but I was stuck with Arlen. That's fine. We all deal with our lot in life. "Son of Zuf, an Ephrathite." Now, that is Elkanah's line. Elkanah is Hannah's husband. And he's a major character in this story, of course. So this is therefore then Samuel's line that is given to us, Elkanah and Hannah. And I'll probably call her Ruth a few times, I would imagine, because I'm stuck on Ruth. But yeah, Elkanah and Hannah's line. So therefore it's Samuel's line. It was actually a Levitical line. And I don't know why there's so much confusion over this. Well, I guess I do. It's because of the mention of the word Ephrathite. But yeah, they're actually Levites. Do you remember what the deal was with the Levites? Where do the Levites live? Nowhere and everywhere, right? They were not given a land inheritance. So you're never going to read in the Bible that someone was from the land of Levi. No, they were not given a land spot. Instead, the Lord did what? He spread them out throughout all of the nation. That was God's message to us, that He wants holiness to be infecting every area of our life and every area of our world. That everywhere we are, everywhere we live, we're being influenced by God for the purpose of holiness. So the Levites were spread out, and you have a family here, and it's confusing because we read that they're Ephrathites, and I just told you that they're Levites. You're probably wondering how I get that. Well, I get that because we're told elsewhere that this is a family of Levites. Samuel is a Levite. Now, one of the kind of cool things about being a Levite is you lived wherever you lived. And then wherever you lived, you could call yourself by that name. So what this is this is a family of Levites living in Ephraim. So if they want to, they can call themselves Levites. They can call themselves Ephrathites, or they can call themselves Ephraimites. It's all accurate. It's all essentially the same. All of that is fine. But because of Elkanah, because of his line not tracing back to Aaron, that would disqualify Samuel from being a priest. There's always a lot of question about, was Samuel a priest? Well, not really. I don't think you ever read anything about Samuel being a priest. Now, he does serve as a tabernacle worker. I mean, even from a young age, he's running around in linen and like acting like a little priest helper. That's what he was doing. And that was fine because he was a Levite. And a Levite could be a tabernacle worker. If you weren't from the family of Aaron, though, if that wasn't your line, then you could not serve as a priest in the tabernacle. And hey, no sweat here, because the Lord doesn't want to use Samuel as a priest. If the Lord wanted to, then the Lord would have brought him through the Levitical line, through the Aaronic line. But the Lord didn't do that because God wants this man, Samuel, to be the final judge and the first of the prophets. He wants Samuel to be instrumental in ushering in this era of transition for the nation of Israel. And we see here the name Elkanah. That means acquired of the Lord. So it kind of sounds like a miracle birth happened just for Elkanah to be produced. I don't know if miracle births run in this family or what, but it would seem that way. For sure, I think we can say that it's a real good guess for us to say that Elkanah's parents were godly parents. I don't think you name your kid something like this if you weren't a godly parent. Acquired from the Lord. If you're naming your kid that, that means, oh man, we really wanted this child and we were really praying for this child and God gave us this child. So that's what we're going to call this child, acquired from the Lord. We prayed, we sought, the Lord gave us this child. And as you will see, Elkanah is a very godly man himself. And that's no small thing considering the time period that this guy is living in. His family. What was that? His family. All right, good. His family was living at a time period when not too many Israelites were serious about serving the Lord. So his family stands out. Elkanah is a wonderful man of God. You'll see that. He reminds me a lot of Boaz. He just has all of those very godly characteristics that a man should have. But godliness does not necessarily come without its challenges, does it? Look at verse 2. He had two wives. Now that is a challenge. Keeping two wives happy, that is a challenge. I'd say it's an impossibility. I still haven't figured out if I think it's a possibility to keep one wife happy. So I don't know. This is bad. This is a challenge. This is a problem. And I will say this. This was a sin. Right? There's nothing about this passage where God is condoning polygamy in any kind of way. The Lord is simply recording accurate history. So if anything, you just read the story and the story is going to tell you that there are really good reasons to avoid polygamy. There are really good reasons why you shouldn't have multiple wives. First of all, the Lord said, don't do it. It's a sin. That should be good enough. It is good enough for me. But if it's not good enough for some, then just keep reading. You're going to see the problems that come from polygamy. He had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and her name means gift or grace. Interesting, if you add Yah, the shortened form of the name Yahweh, if you add Yah to Hannah's name, you have Yahanna. If you make that masculine, it's Yohanan. Do you know what that name is? That's John. That's the name John, Yohanan. And John's name, when you add God to the name, Hannah means gift or grace. What does Yah mean? That's God. So Hannah's name means gift or grace. John's name means God's gift or God's grace. So those names actually are like that. You know, one comes from the other. I'm not sure which one would be the derivation, but they're both essentially the same name, just missing that root name of God. And then, of course, you have the difference between the masculine and feminine. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other wife, Peninnah, which means pearl. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Hannah's barrenness is most likely the reason why Elkanah married this second wife, Peninnah, in the first place. You know how important the perpetuation of an individual's name within the Jewish culture was to men and to families. I mean, succession of the family name, that was like everything to them. Because a lot of things truly depended on that. But for Elkanah to do that, for him to perpetuate his name, he's got to have children. And unfortunately, Hannah cannot help him with that, but Peninnah could. And that's going to contribute to some tension and some competition between these two wives of Elkanah. Now, the really sad part is that once this chapter is over, Elkanah is going to have to live with the knowledge that if he would have just trusted in the Lord and waited on the Lord, he never would have had to take matters into his own hands. He never would have had to marry a wife just for the purpose of having children, basically Peninnah as a concubine. If he just would have been patient and waited on the Lord, trusting in him, he would have found out the Lord had a wonderful plan for his family all along, that the Lord was going to provide, that the Lord was going to make sure his name continued on in the history of the nation. But you know how we humans get? We get impatient. You know, you ask the Lord for something and you get impatient. You're like, Lord, where is it? I prayed about this like 3 hours ago now. And it still hasn't happened. How long is this going to take? Lord, if this doesn't happen for me soon, I'm going to have to move to plan B. Please don't ever do that. Don't ever have a plan B. Just like be smart and make it like this. Plan A through Z, make it all this. Trust in the Lord and wait patiently on him. If that's plan A through Z, then fine. Go to plan B or whatever plan you want to go to. But that needs to be your plan at all times. Wait patiently on the Lord and trust in him. We really read this story and feel for Hannah. We really do. Because we know of the stigma associated with barrenness at this time in the culture that she lived in. This culture believed that fruitfulness was a sign of the blessing of God, the pleasure of God, and that barrenness was a sign of the displeasure of God. To put it plainly, this culture just equated barrenness with sinfulness. If you were barren, you must have done something to like really upset the Lord. You must be an awful and sinful person. And unfortunately for Hannah, she knows that Elkanah is not the problem. She can't like pin this on hubby and say, well, you know, when she's talking with the gals, well, listen, I don't mean to out my hubby, but he's not exactly Mr. Spiritual, and I think that's why the Lord won't give us kids. It's not me, it's him. No, she knows. She knows it's not him. He's doing just fine popping out kids with Peninnah. She knows that procreationally the problem is her, and that's what she's dealing with. That's what she's fighting with in her chest. Those are the emotions that she's struggling with, knowing that the people around her see her in this way. They have a very negative opinion of her, and she's probably fighting that off herself. In Hannah's case, this was eating her alive. You'll see that in her story. You'll see that she's just torn apart over this. She loves the Lord, and the Lord is not blessing her with a child. She wants a child very badly, and it's like one of those things where you're just tearing yourself apart in prayer. Lord, what's wrong with me? What did I do? How did I hurt you? Did I offend you? Lord, is there something I can do to change this? What is the problem with me? There must be a problem with me. Well, actually, there wasn't a problem with Hannah. She wasn't doing anything wrong. In fact, she was doing a lot of things right. She's a wonderful, godly woman. Sometimes barrenness just happens on a fallen planet. And sometimes it's temporary. And sometimes it's permanent. But barrenness or no barrenness, temporary or permanent, if you love the Lord, that is a guarantee that He loves you. You can't get that egg before the chicken. You know what I'm saying? You can't love God if He doesn't love you. Love for God is a response from God's love first. So if you love the Lord, I can promise you He loves you too. And whatever your lot is in life, if you'll just stick with that, loving the Lord and knowing that He loves you and accepting whatever His will is for your life, whatever that looks like right now, whatever that looks like from moment to moment, hey, we're going to do this. I'm going to be fine. I might want to be more fruitful in this one area of my life, but if it's not happening right now, fine. If it never happens, fine. Lord, whatever You have for me, I trust that. I trust that You've got my good in mind here, and that whatever You do in my life, it's going to be a wonderful thing. And I'm going to know that in eternity to come. I'm just going to look back and thank You. Verse 3, now this man, Elkanah, used to go up year by year from his city, which was what? Ramathaim Zophim. Any chance to get that word in again? Used to go up from his city year by year to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh. So that's probably about a 15-mile one-way trek for Elkanah and his family. He would have made that trip to and from, 30 miles round trip, three times a year. Now, how can I possibly know that? Because I know the law of Moses. And this is a guy that follows the law of Moses. The law of Moses tells us in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 16, that all males, regardless of where they live, they were to go to the tabernacle and observe the three feasts three times a year. The first feast was the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which included the Feast of Passover. Those were rolled into one big long observation. Secondly, you have the Feast of Weeks, or the Feast of Harvest. And then thirdly, you have the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles, the camping trip. So Elkanah was obeying the Lord. He was keeping the feasts of the Lord as Moses had commanded. The rest of the nation, what are they doing? Whatever they want. Whatever seems best to them, whatever floats their boat, and whatever strikes their fancy. But Elkanah, probably cross-cultural, probably against grain, he is faithfully serving the Lord. He is faithfully being obedient to the commands of Moses. Now, verse 3 is the first time that the title Lord of Hosts is used, and it means Lord of Armies or Lord of the Masses. And what that is speaking of is it's speaking of God's, it's a title that speaks of God's power over both heaven and earth. So it's a way of ascribing all power and all command in heaven and in earth to the Lord. And that title is given to us in military terms. It's really a military term, right? Now, Hannah will use this title in just a moment in her prayer to the Lord. And I got to tell you, that kind of surprises me. I would expect her to use one of the more sympathetic titles of the Lord. There were a lot of very sympathetic titles for the Lord. And I don't know about you, but like whatever I'm praying about, I try to find a title of the Lord that's going to remind the Lord, like as if He needs the reminder, that He's that kind of God that would answer that kind of prayer. I think of the word etzer in Hebrew. It means helper. I think if I were Hannah, I'd be praying to El Etzer, God my helper. That was the name Etzer that God gave as the title for Eve in the Garden of Eden. He made her the Etzer, the helper. And that's the mother of all procreation. I'd be praying to El Etzer, Lord of all creation, the helper who helped Eve with her procreation. Lord, would you give me a child? But she doesn't use a sympathetic title at all. She doesn't use a, in my opinion, related title in any way for God. Instead, she uses Yahweh Tzabah, Lord of hosts. And I don't know why. Don't really have an answer for that. Except that I like the extents of that. I like the far reaches of that. That the Lord of all power and command was not too busy controlling global powers that he couldn't stop and stoop down and listen to the prayer of a broken heart through tears in her eyes, a place of very deep pain in her heart, but also a heart that was filled with faith. It's the condescending of God to mankind. I love that. And I read Psalm 113 to start our service off with tonight, because again, listen to what verses 4, 5, 6, 7, and 9 say. It says, "The Lord is high above all nations. He could not be more out of our reach than he is. And his glory above the heavens, who is like the Lord God seated on high, who looks far down on the heavens and the earth. And yet, he raises the poor from the dust. And he lifts the needy from the ash heap. And he gives the barren woman a home, making her the joyous mother of children. Praise the Lord." Isn't that amazing? The condescending of God from his loftiness to our lowliness, to see the personal needs we have, to feel our brokenness, to respond to that brokenness, and actually care and actually meet those needs. It's such a beautiful contrast to me. Reading on in verse 3, "Year by year, Elkanah came to Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord." So there's an introduction to the sons of Eli, the priest, Hophni and Phinehas, and that is here for a reason. It's giving us a little bit of advance notice so that we can get ready to know them all too well in chapter 2. They are horrible, terrible priests. They are terrible men. We will find out that they are taking advantage of the offerings that are being brought into the tabernacle. This was all mapped out by the law of Moses. The priests knew what portion of the meat they were supposed to take, and they knew how much. But these two guys, Hophni and Phinehas, they were taking advantage of the people that were bringing their offerings into the tabernacle. They were using their positions in ministry to rob people. They demanded their preferred choice of cut. They chose the best cuts of the meat that they liked instead of following the Lord's law. And they took a fork and they stuck the fork in there and they pull out from the meat as much as they could. And whatever they could pull out in one swipe with the fork, probably had the biggest fork they could have, that was theirs to keep, and they left the people with the rest. In modern terms, they were using the ministry for personal wealth. The ministry was nothing more than a get-rich-quick scheme for them. And I would love to talk about TV evangelists right now. You all know my affinity for that topic. But we don't have time for me to rant about that, so I'm going to let that pass, and I'm going to move right on to their next sin. Hophni and Phinehas, they also were having relations, inappropriate relations, with the women who were serving as greeters in the tabernacle. So they were committing all sorts of grievous sins. Their hearts definitely were not to serve the Lord. One of two things is possible here. Either the family of Elkanah knew about the ministry corruption, or they did not. And either way, I respect them for it. If they did not know about the ministry corruption, then I say good for them that they weren't busybodies, happened to be nosing into everyone's business, finding out the scoop on everyone, knowing the gossip, hearing the stories. Did you hear about the ministry workers? Oh my, I'm just grateful that they minded their own business and their eyes were fixed on the Lord. They were just focused on their service to the Lord and being obedient to Him. They weren't paying attention to the lives of the ministry workers. I really like that. I love that verse in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 11, where Paul tells us to aspire to live quietly and mind your own business. I like that. Mind your own business. And then he says in verse 1 of that same chapter, Paul says that we are to just walk how we're supposed to walk and please God. There you go. That's the perfect combination right there. Aspire to live a quiet life. Be at peace with people. Mind your own business. Just do what you need to do. Do what you know you should do to walk with the Lord and to please the Lord. That's like the whole sum total of life right there. You keep your eyes on those things, you're going to do very well. If they did know about the ministry corruption, then I would say they deserve even more credit for that. Because that could have very easily discouraged them from going to the temple three times a year. You know, like, well, maybe we'll just find ourselves, or pardon me, the tabernacle. Maybe we'll just find ourselves another tabernacle. Maybe we'll build our own. Let's start our own tabernacle. You know, we'll call it Tabernacle Fellowship. There could have been a temptation to do that, but again, their eyes are just fixed on the Lord and serving the Lord, doing what they know is right according to the law of Moses and the commands of the Lord. We know what this looks like today in 2024. We know there are many people who say, well, I don't go to church because there are too many hypocrites there. Or I don't go to church because the ministry, it's all corrupt. They're just wanting to get wealthy. They're just trying to take advantage of people to further themselves. But listen, whether that's true or not, you are still responsible for being faithful to God for yourself. All right? You're still responsible for that. I don't care who's in church and who's not, faithful or unfaithful, hypocrite or sincere, corrupt or uncorrupt, whoever is at church, it doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is, God still requires that you be faithful to Him of the commands that He's given you in your life. So I would just say this, instead of not going because of hypocrites or because of corruption, I say go to church and show those hypocrites how to be faithful to God. Lead the way. If you want to see different, you know, levels of spirituality in the congregation, have fun. Make the change. Be the transitional figurehead for that church, even as Samuel will be for the nation of Israel. Now, before we read on, I want to single out Phinehas because I think he ruins the name Phinehas. And if you remember this, in the book of Numbers, we had another guy that was named Phinehas. And man, he set the bar high for this name. I mean, from this guy, during the life of Moses, Numbers chapter 25, this guy set the bar for the name Phinehas high. This was the guy, the priest, the son of Eleazar the priest, who was there with Moses and the priests and the elders of the city when Moses, they were having this public meeting, and they were scolding the nation for intermarriage with Midianites and Moabites, right? They were saying, stop marrying Moabites. Cut it out. Stop it. They are pulling you away from God. They're turning you to idolatry. They're turning you to polytheism. They're turning you into spiritually corrupt people. Knock it off. And right as they're having that meeting, I mean, right as the meeting's going on, Moses is probably giving the oration. And here comes a Jew with his Midianite date. And they're frolicking along. They make their way to his tent and disappear behind the tent flaps. And it was this guy, Phinehas, the first iteration, the first use of the name. Phinehas, when he saw that, he was essentially like this. Oh, no, not on my watch. That is not happening. And we read that Phinehas took a spear. He barged in on them in the act, in the tent, and pierced both of them through with one strike. And the Lord said to Moses, all right, we're good. Phinehas, what he did has appeased my wrath. My wrath is gone. Phinehas appeased my wrath. Seeing how jealous that guy was for me and for the nation, that has appeased my wrath. That one guy. Man, what a moment in Jewish history. What a good start for the name Phinehas. And then here's this guy, Phinehas, the son of Eli. And he's a charlatan along with his brother, Hophni. And yeah, it kind of ruins the name. Verse 4, on the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. So the portions would be the leftovers from the offerings. Whatever the priest didn't steal, whatever they did leave, those portions were then divvied up among the family. And for Peninnah and her children, his children too, but his children through Peninnah, all of them got an individual portion. They all got a single portion of whatever those offering leftovers were. Now, verse 5, I mean, that's normal, right? But now you read verse 5, and it says in verse 5, but to Hannah, he gave a double portion. Why? Because he loved her. How much more did he love her than Peninnah? I would say just look at the portions. I think he loved her probably twice as much. He gave her a double portion because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. And this sort of thing is one of the major problems with polygamy. It is not going to work for the simple reason that someone is always going to be favored, the other one is always going to be jealous, and that is always going to cause problems. Notice here the Lord had closed Hannah's womb, so this one we cannot just chalk up to life on this planet. God did this with Hannah intentionally. I do believe that conception is in God's hands. I mean, he threw that act, procreation, conception, he threw that into world motion. And I think he can be as hands-off or as hands-on with that as he wants to be. I think it's God's prerogative to let things run course of life. I believe it's also God's prerogative to step in and make a womb barren if he wants, or to make a womb fruitful if he wants. That's his right. It's his prerogative as God to do those things. And in this case, he intentionally does it to Hannah. Is it cruel that the Lord does that to Hannah? No, it's glorious that the Lord does this to Hannah. God closing her womb, first of all, it was temporary, and it was temporary for a good reason. It eventually gives God something that he wants from Hannah. I'm not going to reveal what that is yet. It's further on in the chapter. It's looking like we're not going to make it there tonight. So come back next week to find out. But God wants something specific from Hannah. He wants something specific from her. And when God gets that, the final results of all of this are going to be grander and greater than if God did not temporarily cause the womb of Hannah to be barren. Because of that temporary barrenness for her womb, she's going to be all the more blessed. And then the whole world is going to be all the more blessed, because now we get to read this story of faith and trust and prayer and God's answer and miracles. And we get the results, the fruit that comes from this once barren womb. And it's a big deal. It's a wonderful character that comes to us in the history of this book as a result of exactly what God is setting up in all of these specifics here. So no, it's not cruel. God's doing something extremely special in the life of Hannah. Verse 6, and her rival, Peninnah, same thing. Peninnah used to provoke her grievously, to irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. So poor Hannah, she had to deal with all the internal struggle from this, all of the hurt from wanting a child so bad and being incapable of getting that child. I cannot pretend to know what that pain is like. I know we have several in this fellowship that have experienced that. It's tough. I understand that. I get the idea of it. I can't understand the depth of it as being a man, but she's dealing with all of that internal gut-wrenching trauma, and then to make matters worse, if that wasn't enough, the pain that she's carrying around, the stigma that's on her from society, if that's not enough, then she's got the other wife, Peninnah, taking pot shots at her every chance she gets. getting her digs in every chance that she gets. You know, it's one of those things where, oh, hey, Hannah, hey, my youngest grew out of these little overalls. Do you want these for your church? Oh, that's right. You're barren. You can't have a child. So she's doing that kind of thing constantly to Hannah, just for the purpose of being cruel. But is there more to it than that? Yeah, I think there's more to it than that. I'll tell you why she's really doing this. The underlying reason as to why she's taking these pot shots at Hannah and rubbing in the whole I can have children and you can't thing, the reason she's doing that is because she's jealous of Hannah. Wouldn't you agree? Wait a minute. Wait. How could the fruitful one be jealous of the barren one? Well, do you not think she didn't notice the double portions to Hannah? She's a wife in the home. Do you not think she didn't notice that Elkanah favored Hannah? You don't think she realized that Hannah was the loved one and she was just the service item? She was the glorified concubine for the purpose of producing kids. You don't think she understood that, knew that? You don't think she's jealous? Of course she's jealous. You would think that Hannah would be the one that would be jealous of Peninnah. And to be sure, I'm pretty sure she would be. I'm pretty sure she was jealous of the kid thing. I'm sure there was jealousy on both sides of this. And that made the tension, the arguments, and the competition a whole lot more intense. But Peninnah is jealous of Hannah because she knows Hannah is the favorite wife. She knows that Hannah is the loved ones. Look, you can just read the stories of Sarah and Hagar, of Leah and Rachel, and this story here, Peninnah and Hannah, and you just get the point that there is no amount of children that will keep a wife from being jealous from the other wife if they know that other wife has the heart of the husband. If that's the wife that the husband loves, then the other wife is going to be the jealous one. That's going to be tough to deal with. Long story short, men, just stick with one wife. Verse 7. Cannot believe I didn't get one single amen there. Verse 7. So there we go. So it went on year by year. This happened year after year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord. See, Elkanah was taking the whole family when he went. And as often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. It's no surprise that this taunting got worse right around tabernacle time. What's happening at tabernacle time? His favoritism's really showing at tabernacle time. Hannah's getting the double portion. Everyone else is getting the single portion. So yeah, the taunting, it's going to be worse during tabernacle time. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. Now, I believe the verse starts by giving us the year to year, but then it ends on a specific year. So on this specific year of travel to the tabernacle, Hannah's just fed up at this point. She's just reached the bottom of the line. She has finally been broken down by all of this, and she's not eating. She's weeping. She's fasting intentionally or unintentionally. It's hard to say, but this has just got her torn up. Verse 8. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Ladies, this is just guy stuff here. I mean, he's been in this three-way marriage for how long? He knows that Peninnah is popping out children. He knows that Hannah's barren. He knows all of these things. He's hearing the arguments back and forth. He knows every year this is worse. This is tougher on Hannah. And yet here he is, typical guy. What in the world's got you down? And he says this, I love this. Am I not more to you than 10 sons? You know, how could you possibly be sad when you got me? I mean, am I not better for you, more valuable to you than 10 sons? I say this sort of thing to Maggie all the time. Maggie, how could you possibly be down? You're married to me. You got it all, babe. No, of course, I have never said that to Maggie when I was being serious. Maybe I might have said things like that when I was joking, but truly that's what Elkanah has said to Hannah here. Hannah, you got me. What else could you want? I'm like the equivalent of 10 sons, aren't I? And look at verse 9. You'll notice Hannah never answers him. Honey, aren't I better, more valuable to you than 10 sons? And then crickets. Probably the best thing she could have done. She probably went back to weeping. My guess is she'd be weeping even harder now, because now she's not just praying, oh, Lord, help me because I'm barren. Now she's praying, Lord, help me because I'm barren and I'm also stuck with Mr. God's gift to women here. Lord, help me. What a mess I'm in. Ladies, you do need to know this, though. And if you're married, I hope you know this by now. God did not give you a husband to fully understand you and to fully satisfy you. This is the truth of the matter. That husband of yours, that man that you're thinking about marrying, they will never be able to fully understand you. They will never be able to satisfy you. Now, it's not just the man and the woman thing. It's the woman and the man thing, too. No woman is going to ever be able to understand a man. Believe me. Why is he such a lunkhead? You're not going to be able to understand your man, and you're not going to completely be able to satisfy him as well. God did not create man and woman this side of the fall, I should say, with the ability to have perfect knowledge over husband and wife, over spouse, and to be able to completely satisfy and fulfill our partners. Only Christ can do that. He's the missing piece of us, and it's the most important piece of us. It's the spiritual piece of us. Only Christ can do that. One of the things I always teach in premarital counseling is that both spouses need to be very careful about the expectations they place on one another. You remember this, Will, Rachel? Yeah, I think you probably do. Yeah. Barry, Megan, you remember this? Yeah, I teach this to everyone. I'm like, listen, the more expectations you put on your spouse, the more potential that is for a serious downfall and then division between you. It's going to cause you frustration. It's going to cause marital collapse. It's going to drive you two apart. So you set the base minimum expectations for your spouse. You do need to have some. You need to have the expectation that your spouse be a godly spouse. You need to have those kinds of expectations. But apart from those, every other expectation you have for your spouse or your future spouse, get rid of it. It's only really just a potential trap for disappointment and distance between the two of you. Just consider the woman at the well. Why do you think she had five husbands? You think she just didn't find the right guy? She just didn't meet Mr. Right? Or was it just that she was the problem? Or was it just that there were no good dating services back then? Or was it just that she was one of those gals that just gravitated toward the hard cases and always picked the worst of guys? No, it was none of that. The reason she was married four times and was on guy number five, working him for marriage, is because in terms of understanding and satisfaction and fulfillment, she was drinking from the wrong well. And once she found the wrong well, the guy didn't matter. Any of the five, I would imagine, would have worked, because she had found the living water that satisfies, that understands, that comforts. She had found the living water that completes her and fulfills her. We're going to begin at chapter 1, verse 9 next week. I'm going to cut myself some slack on this because we did have a book study introduction here. So that usually slows us down in the chapter study a bit. But we'll pick up right here. I mean, I love this note we're finishing up on. Honey, how could you be sad? You're married to me. You got it all, honey. I wish I were in your shoes. I wish I had such a great spouse. That's a great note to finish on. And we'll pick up in verse 9 after her silence next week. Let's stand and pray.